Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Dublin Airport's Airport Club. Make travel effortless with lounge access, stress-free parking, fast-track security and exclusive duty-free savings.
Good morning. We know we're in a housing crisis, not exactly breaking news. But if you wanted an insight into just how difficult it is to buy, well, have a listen to this. With Colm in for Clare, personal finance expert Owen McGee. It's not pretty.
The average person in Ireland earns €4,242 per month. That's the average earnings, about 50 grand a year, right? That's average. And that turns into after tax, €3,350 after tax. And again, I have to make a few assumptions here. When it comes to the cost of living, there's loads of different data and sources that you can pull from. But I picked one that I was very happy with. And it says that a single person spends just over €1,000 a month on their living expenses. And some people are going to gall at that number and say you cannot live in Ireland for €1,000 a month. But the rent then, the average rent in Ireland has just gone over €2,000 to €2,053 per month.
Huge, yeah.
Huge. So if you add those two figures together, you're ending up at little over €3,000 a month is what it's costing you just to rent and to live.
So that like, that's like
most of
maybe
your,
300 quid left over.
294, I think, is the actual number that's left over.
Okay.
So the average house price in Ireland is €346,000. That means you need a deposit of 10% for most people, which is €34,600. And you're going to need costs for solicitors and stuff for about €10,000. So let's say you're going to need savings of €45,000. If you take how much we earn on average and how much we spend on average and you save the difference to raise the money for a deposit for the average person to buy the average house on the average salary in Ireland today, it's going to take 13 years to save the deposit.
13 years?
Exactly.
Wow. And not just confined to Dublin. Take a bow, Galway.
I picked North County Dublin. So Dublin's generally in these reports is split up into a couple of different areas. I picked North County Dublin because it was the highest growing in Dublin last year, grew by just over 15% in the last 12 months, the price of housing. And in North County Dublin now, it's going to take you 15 years and 4 months because you're going to need a deposit plus costs of 52,000. Dublin city centre grew the least last year and it still grew by 9% or just under 9% last year. And it's 14 years and 10 months there.
Okay, down that that's you're looking at a price because it's 405,000 euro average price of a house in Dublin city centre.
Absolutely, yeah. And North County Dublin is 420. Now, if I went to South Dublin, it'd be even more miserable where it's the most expensive in Dublin. But if we go down to Cork, you're still at 13 and a half years in Cork City. And in Galway City, you're back to 15 years again.
And the price there higher than Dublin city centre?
Absolutely. House prices in Galway City now are averaging €409,000.
And how long again for Galway?
15 years.
Scary stuff. And all of this, a backdrop to Wednesday's Morning Ireland and this call for a boycott of holiday home owners in Mayo. With Mary, Tom Gilligan, Director of Services for Housing and Roads at Mayo County Council.
According to the 2022 census, there are 5,987 holiday homes in Mayo. And in the middle of a housing crisis, we need homes for people, not just for seasons. So the idea around that, the objective around this proposed boycott is to highlight the impact of underused housing stock on local communities, encourage policy reform and taxation measures on vacant second homes, and also as well to, you know, push holiday homeowners to either return properties for sale to the rental market or to the long-term rental market.
But Mary dug a little deeper into exactly what he had proposed in his email to members of the local authority's strategic policy committee, his four-point plan to put pressure on holiday home owners to sell or long-term rent.
Are you proposing now that people should take to the streets, that people should protest?
Well, as I said, this is a proposal to the Housing SPC. It's not a policy.
Okay, you said public campaigns, posters, community meetings encouraging solidarity, social pressure, including open letters, local resolutions, avoiding patronage of businesses or services owned by absentee landlords, refusing engagement with holiday homeowners.
Yep.
That's strong stuff.
It's demanding accountability from property, you know, holiday homeowners. And it is all about, here, Mary, it is all about trying to get these underutilised, vacant, empty homes back into use.
And then the use of that word boycott, particularly emotive for the county.
The word boycott is synonymous with Mayo, and I know in relation to Captain Boycott, who was an absentee landlord with lands in Mayo. And, you know, the local community at the time took it upon themselves, I suppose, to try and as a form of civil protest.
So, was he standing by his call? Most certainly.
Do you regret the email now?
No, I don't.
Do you regret the strong language, the use of the word boycott?
No, because, I mean, the word boycott has been around, you know, since the 19th century. It originated in Mayo. And I mean, you know, governments have used it, individuals have used it to try and bring pressure in order to get things done. We are in the middle of a housing crisis.
Okay.
It's very important that we look at all options. And even as the housing minister, James Brown, says, you know, nothing is off the table.
Well, and he also says, and he's quoted in Ivan Murray's article as saying, personal boycotts of this nature of any homeowner have not been called for by Minister Brown.
But as I said, nothing is off the table.
All right.
And later on Drive Time, the discussion continued. Joining Cormac, Moira Ní Bhfiorchú, CEO of the Irish Self-Catering Federation.
What is your reaction to what Tom Gilligan proposed?
I think it's appalling. It's going back to the dark ages. I never thought we would hear Captain Boycott being mentioned again in County Mayo. And to talk like this about an industry which is mostly run by women, over the age of 45, most of them have one property. It is their main income, and they welcome people to their self-catering properties. I think it's an appalling thing
to
hear.
So are you saying then that the owners of holiday homes and short-term lets, they're not part of the problem here in terms of the housing crisis?
No, I don't think they are. No.
Not so fast, though, because here comes Peter Flynn, chairman of Mayo County Council's Strategic Housing Policy Group. Now, he was in no way supportive of Tom Gilligan's call to boycott, calling it a distraction, but he did have an issue with holiday homes.
They definitely are part of the problem, Cormac. There's no question about it. I mean, holiday homes have always been part of the tourism industry in Ireland. But the problem that we've encountered in recent years is the alarming increase in numbers. And again, if you look at the RSI report that was issued recently in relation to Airbnb, at a national level, they didn't highlight any great difficulty with it. But within certain pockets within Ireland, there was major issues. And Mayo came up as number one on it, where one in three properties in the Westport area were now Airbnb properties. That doesn't take into account all the other short-term holiday lets that are here. And it doesn't take into account that you are displacing people who are in residential homes, people who are in apartments, who are now being converted into short-term lets, and that is having a disproportionate impact.
And where you are in Westport,
and the rental market.
Where you are in Westport, Peter, where you're a councillor, it's a really beautiful part of the country, a big tourist town as well. Do people complain about holiday homes being vacant?
They do. Yeah, no, there's no question about it. I mean, it's the vacancy is one aspect of it. And the second is the fact that if you're a neighbour of some of these houses, it can be, you know, can be difficult as well, particularly over weekends.
Not called holiday homes for nothing. But Cormac put this to the Fine Gael councillor.
These people have property rights. And it's up to them, once they have this property, to do with that house what they will. Is it not a bit rich for Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil, if they propose something like this, to target a group who have constitutional property rights because of the inaction of your parties in government in terms of the housing crisis?
All we're trying to do is rebalance the issue there between the social need and the economic need. Right now, over the last number of years, we've allowed a scenario to unfold where the numbers moving into the likes of Airbnbs and other short-term lets has increased exponentially. We need to rebalance that. We need to bring in... I would love to avoid any form of taxation if people would decide ultimately through the taxation system to move into the long-term lets. But unfortunately, the government haven't moved on this. They don't see this as an issue for rural for Dublin. They see it as an issue for... And they don't recognise the issue in rural Ireland. So that's why, as a council, we're looking at our own solutions to try and equalise the system. And I really don't make any apologies for that. I think we have to think outside the box.
Okay.
We have to do something to try and help encourage people to move into the county that want to be part of the community. We need to encourage people that are local to the area to stay in the area.
Okay.
And right now, that is nearly impossible.
Well, this is a hot topic, I can tell you.
And hot topics make a good live line. Here's Debbie. She's not really sure about a boycott, but she did have this to say.
I'm living on the Sheepshead Peninsula just outside Bantry. But a major thing out here would be planning. And the lack of planning for locals because of the high density of houses being built in the coastal villages and communities. And then when a local wants to build, they're told there's a high density of housing, but there's nobody living in these houses. And there's coastal communities all over Kerry, all over Galway, all over Cork. And the schools are closing. Because I know for a fact one coastal school next to, near us here had no pupils starting in 2024. And there's houses all around that school with nobody living in them. There's shops closing. They're talking about the post office on the radio all day today. There's post offices closing because there's nobody living in the communities. It's all people coming in for July and August and then they're gone. Shut up shop in September until next year again. It's just absolutely crippling the fabric of rural communities, I think.
But then Kerry holiday home owner Flan came on the line, and as far as he is concerned, well, he's practically local.
How much time would you spend there?
I would spend, to give you an idea, when COVID came, very often I would spend Christmas with my extended family in Dublin. But because we couldn't travel, we couldn't mix and all that, I decided to go to Kerry for a few days over Christmas of that year. And I went down on the 23rd of December. I didn't come back till the 1st of March. Last Saturday, I came back from Kerry after spending 8 days down there. Anything that needs to be done, I get local labour to do it. And I'm doing that regularly. And I, as far as I'm concerned, we're a part of the local community down there. But sorry, Flan,
just to, because that is the point that Debbie was making. Like, for how many weeks of the year would your house be empty down there?
Not many at all. I'd be up and down there all year round.
But it was to holiday home owner Mary that Katie put this particular question.
But I wonder, has this become a kind of a moral issue almost? Because I have seen this discussed elsewhere, the idea that having two homes in a housing crisis is somehow, you know, a moral question now.
But I don't understand why you're asking me this moral question.
Oh, I'm just saying that has it become something that people are kind of uncomfortable about? The fact that we know so many people are so desperately trying to get on the property ladder, to get a roof over their head.
Have we gone into a country or a state where if someone is able to have, and very luckily have, there is a problem by them having it?
I'm just throwing that out there. Have you come across any judgment on it or anything like that?
Well, I just thought what I heard today about Mayo was a bit odd. And maybe I'm wrong in what I'm saying, but, it's not like everyone is very rich and I'm not rich. But I'm just trying to say that, you know, holiday homes are not pariahs. Give to the community in the area, and I just found it bad.
Liveline on Wednesday. And before the week was out, Mayo County Council's Tom Gilligan apologised for any concern or distress his boycott proposal had caused. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Continuing on something of a theme, housing that is, on Arena, choreographer and performer Luke Murphy talked to Sean about Scorched Earth, a kind of dance crime drama with a nod to John B. Keane's The Field. And it digs deep into our relationship with the land and ownership.
It's so atmospheric and it is like the beginning of a Scandinavian war film. So this is over the opening scene. What are we looking at as this music is playing in front of us?
So the show opens a series of slides play out on this slide projector, and we start to kind of see a series of pictures from a crime scene and excerpts from a an imaginary government commissioned report. And in the world of our show, there's been a report commissioned called the Green Report, which is looking into the pattern of land-based crimes in Ireland. And in response to that report, an investigator has been appointed to kind of look into historical crimes that weren't fully investigated. So we're learning that that's the setup as this music is kind of coming in.
And it's so atmospheric. It really is so atmospheric.
Shivers. And Murphy talked about housing and the boundaries that divide us. Petty, yes, but also very human.
You know, when you're making anything, the first place you start is what's your relationship to what you're curious about. And even in myself, when I kind of hit that age where everyone around you and everyone else of your age kind of feels like they're supposed to start buying things, you should be buying a house, you know, you should be thinking about buying a house now. And you kind of feel that pressure, and then you understand in yourself like what it is that, why do you want to have something? And I've noticed, because I've lived abroad for so long and I've spent so much of my life not in Ireland, that I always found I had a much stronger feeling about like what was mine and what was mine and what wasn't than a lot of the people around me. And when I came back to Ireland, you know, you just started seeing that in different forms. When I first moved back to Cork, I was living in a house and my neighbour painted their house, and they kind of painted past the gutter, you know,
gutter.
You know, and it's so meaningless in one way, and at the same time you notice it.
In fact,
you could
argue that they were doing you a favour to keep it look well.
It was a much nicer shade of paint than I was using, yeah. But or seeing like a really heated argument between two neighbours about the unspoken etiquette of a car parking space in front of their houses or something like that, you know. So you kind of see the different forms it takes. Or, you know, you planted your hedge on what used to be my side of when there was a fence. Actually, the fence was here, and now you've planted hedges as a boundary instead of a fence, but you actually planted them on this side of where the fence used to be. And, you know, so there's these kind of really small forms that this kind of tension takes. And then there's the really big forms that the tension takes. And I feel it. I feel it in myself, and I also feel like you see it around you everywhere, in extreme and in really small ways.
Luke Murphy with Sean on Arena, and with the Darcy in an echo of earlier themes, holiday homes and problems. Lovely problems, but problems nevertheless.
This might seem like a very first world problem, but I don't know how to handle it. We have a small holiday mobile home that belonged to my parents, and we share between us grown-up siblings now that they have passed. We usually manage it through a shared calendar in the summer, but this year, my sister has just booked herself on every available weekend, including the bank holidays, for her and her friends. She kind of adopted a you snooze, you lose approach. But it means me and the kids have nowhere to go this summer. I've started a new job, so don't have a lot of time off, and was relying on a couple of weekends near the sea for decompression. I just find it so selfish on her part, but she tends to hold a grudge, and I don't want to create a family feud. Is there any way, do you think, of cajoling her to cancel without falling out? Alison
Keating.
Well, maybe you need to fall out. No, I'm not joking. This is a really hard thing, and I'm actually thinking of the reality of how to deal with this, and I really feel this person's like, I don't want to cause problems here, but the sister is not caring about the impact it's having on everyone else. So there's such strong sibling dynamics at play here. I'm wondering what age the person who's booked. I'm going to take a wild assumption, say the person who booked all the dates in is the eldest.
Do you think?
Yes. I think that there's a real control mechanism that that the person's going to hold a grudge against you if you go back and say, I'm not very happy about this. So that's a real strong control mechanism when you know how someone's behaviour is going to be before you've even done it. So I'm saying, actually, maybe there needs to be a bit of a cycle break here and go in and actually say, look, I'm totally honest. This is actually this is unfair. I actually do want to go sometimes. This is for all the siblings. Can we please sit down together? I know you've booked in already, but it's actually not going to work.
Ooh, and there goes the family barbecue, and possibly a torch might get set to the mobile home. What do the Rays, Darcy and O'Neill think?
I think they need a new system. They do. It seems to be a little bit all over the place, doesn't it?
Oh, look, they've already fallen out. Like, that's what's already happened. But it wrecks my head that the sibling or the person who kind of goes, what's happened, becomes the problem rather than the person mm-hmm. who actually makes things happen. So let's be clear. You haven't caused this. It already has happened and your sister's made a decision. So again, I think like Alison, you kind of have to be direct with it. And you just say, look, is there any room to negotiate? You've kind of made all these weekends. Like, is there any chance I could get this weekend or that weekend? And I suppose I'm curious what the other siblings think and feel.
Yeah.
Not that I want to create some kind of Game of Thrones alliances to knock out the Queen of Dragons, but it's just you do need to check in and see what the others are feeling. Because if they're like, go against you, that's going to have a family feud. But if they can kind of go, actually, yeah, no, I feel the same, then at least you have an ally that hopefully can have a reasonable conversation.
But you're saying they have to call out Pavia.
Yes.
They have to call
Go in there and create a little soft revolution and, yes. and get a sort and go on holidays, go to the beach.
And say, I heard the man on the radio say you need a new system. Okay, I hope that works out and it doesn't spoil your summer.
And they never spoke again. Oh, what you wouldn't give for the follow-up email. And staying in the realm of relationships and negotiation, the man who governments call upon to settle scraps, the go-to mediator for industrial relations. Soft-spoken, yes, but steely as well. We speak of Ciarán Mulvey, who was Oliver's visiting critic yesterday. Now, he'd gone to Wellfest, all your fitness and health needs catered for. He'd liked it, but he hadn't signed up for every class.
There was one on orgasm. I didn't go to that one, but...
Did you skip that one?
Well, I was tempted, but I said...
Imagine the crack.
Life goes on. Interesting.
Now we'll never know what was going on in that tent. Think of the free samples. Anyway.
Oh, yes. No, we won't go there, will we?
Please don't. But it was his talk of mediation tactics that really caught the ear. So if anyone's annoying you over the weekend, here are some insider tricks to get your own way.
In everything you've learned in mediation, does everyone have to come down off their perch a little bit in order for the thing to be solved? Is that what that's happened every single time?
Well, in a lot of the disputes, people want to spend time venting their anger and their annoyance and their upset and the imperative of getting change for companies. So you allow them to vent largely. Then you, as one of my colleagues once described, he says, why do you love bombing them, Ciarán? I says, well, you need to create a bit of empathy because when you're delivering the bad news in a few nights later, need to have a relationship.
So
you
butter them up. And
And then look, there comes a stage where you're the person in the room that has to talk truth to both sides and tell it as it is and then you formulate on the basis of that exchange what a settlement would look like and you do the shuttle diplomacy between both sides.
You've such a calm voice as well. I could see that working.
I have the other voice when it needs.
Is there the other voice?
No, yeah, don't take me for a shuriken violet here.
That's for sure.
But if none of that works, lock them in a room and go for a little bit of sleep deprivation. Pull an all-nighter.
Does that work or is that just rubbish?
It does in the sense that you create a momentum because you're up against a strike deadline. And might be the health service, aviation, healthcare, whatever, or a company going to close because they can't get the changes. So to a large degree, you know, there's a momentum around those. And then you'd exhaust them too. The one to go home after 5 days for their breakfast.
And that can work. That's a really good tactic.
It can work because you keep them focused. You keep them at it. You don't have them going back talking to other people. Now, the mobile phone has changed that a little bit. But, you know, you have them. Right. Don't let them out.
Top tips from one of the best, Ciarán Mulvey with Oliver. Now, do you remember where you were when this happened?
Votes in favour of the proposal, 1,201,607. Any vote you agree in favour, chat votes to the following amount of people. Votes against the proposal, 734,000.
A momentous day for Ireland, and what a crowd at Dublin Castle. The sun, the colours. Can you believe it's 10 years since the marriage equality referendum? Joining Miriam on Sunday, campaigner Gráinne Healy.
People say to us, oh, the campaign was so quick, February to May. I say, I was in weekly meetings with Marriage Equality for 10 years before the referendum was called. But one of the things that we did in Marriage Equality, and again, our director, Mininia Griffiths, did a brilliant job on this, was getting gays from around the country to be willing to go on local radio to say why marriage was important to them. Getting their parents to say why they wanted their children to be able to settle down. Those stories reached out to, I mean, our target audience was Mrs. Smith in Mullingar. This mythical woman who was well disposed but thought maybe she didn't know any gays. So she would hear these stories and her reaction should be, Asher, why wouldn't you vote for them? Isn't that lovely? That was the tone of the conversation, and it was always about conversations. We were not there to tell people how to vote. So when volunteers came to us and said they wanted to knock on doors, could they have training? The training they got was you knocked on the door and you said, hello, I'm voting yes in the forthcoming referendum. Can I tell you why? That's how we got people to start talking. And the stories that were coming out on the radio or in magazines from very brave, courageous couples, even if people think they know you, if you're living in towns, some people still keep the head below the radar. So getting brave people to come forward and say, I think marriage is important, was really crucial in the strategy of women.
And also,
and for Rory O'Neill, a.k.a. Panty Bliss, the decisive vote had made a difference he could feel and see.
People, I think, were surprised at how big the moment felt on the day and post the day. If you had asked me the day before the referendum, at that point, I suspected that most Irish people were OK with us. I certainly hoped that they were, but I didn't know that they were. And I would have thought the day before the referendum that if it was the answer was yes, that really nothing would much would have changed except that gay couples would have been allowed to get married and gay families would have been more secure and all that. But in actual fact, there's a real power in knowing that merely hoping doesn't provide. And I think that was very visible immediately. And you've mentioned that you saw, you know, older couples, you know, hugging and kissing in that at the castle. You know, for the next, you know, for months afterwards, I was so keenly aware that everywhere I was walking around Dublin, I was seeing, you know, gay and lesbian couples holding hands in a way that you simply didn't, you know, before the referendum result. And the reason for that is the power of knowing that most people are on your side. And there's something really powerful about that.
From Sunday with Miriam. And after all that, let's have a bit of joy. Donald Deneen in for JK on Lyric.
We're going to continue in the rapid-fire Colombian round now. This particular tune is very meaningful to me. Personally, it's the one, it was kind of a doorway into cumbia, and I discovered this through seeing and hearing Joe Strummer talking about its influence on The Clash, and it's all in here in La Sonora Cordobesa. We'll be right back.
Too early to start the party? I don't think so. Back in a bit. Welcome back. At the weekend with Brendan Fogg-Williams, you know the voice, you know the woman, and the podcaster has just released Big Mouth, an autobiography. Cringe.
God, I hate that word so much. I know it's kind of what's said, but I feel like autobiography, I kind of like to see it as a collection of stories, a lot of which include me, but some which include other people. That's meant to be lighthearted and fun.
Yeah, yeah. Were you reading that off a card or something? Come here, you've a very funny line in the introduction. I don't know how much more of me people can take.
That is also true. But I tried to do it so that it was things that people had never heard about me before, which, if you can imagine, was difficult because I've put a lot out there.
Now, she grew up in Howth and her parents divorced when she was quite small.
Your dad, Freddie, he looms large in the book. You were really mad about him, weren't you?
I was mad about him. He was a big character.
Yeah, tell me a bit about him. He was colourful, fond of a drink.
Very fond. I like to say that, yeah, he was fond of a drink. We spent a lot of time with him. A lot of that time was in the pub. But, I mean, my parents broke up when I was about 7 or 8, and he was very much involved in our life. Like, he really enjoyed picking us up and taking us out, and he was always there. He never let us down. And he was just a really, really great dad. But he was in and out of hospital for most of my life. And I think writing the book, it was only when I wrote the book that I thought that actually that had a massive effect on me from the age of 12, seeing my dad so unwell so often. And I kind of figured out a lot of things about myself from putting that down on paper. But
yeah, like what?
I always thought that my anxiety stemmed from going through a very public breakup. But I think actually my anxiety probably stemmed from my dad being sick all the time and having to kind of deal with that as a very young girl at the time, and then him passing away when I was young enough as well. I think that whole thing probably was what started it off, because I was very unsure of how he was and if he, like, there was so many times that we were unsure if he'd make it, and I think that puts a lot of stress on a child for sure.
And although Vogue was mad for her dad, her mom, not so much.
It's tricky as well, was it? Because your mother, after they split up, she didn't even allow Freddie's name to be mentioned in the house. Is that right?
Not a fan. Not a fan. I think she was well within her rights to feel the way she did. I think that she went through a very difficult many years with my dad, and I think I find it, I say it in the book as well, I love my dad so much, but I wouldn't want to be married to him.
Cue Brendan's next question.
Now, when you say you wouldn't like to have been married to him, you say in the book that Freddie left you with this interesting legacy as well, which is that you've always been drawn to men who like a drink.
I know. Well, actually, a therapist informed me of that, because I went to therapy to try and figure out why I kept going for relationships that just were not working out. And I think when you're a child of somebody who drinks quite regularly, you find people drinking very regularly a normal thing, and I've always been drawn to people like that, or people, I mean, I had my first crush was Eric Cantona. He was on my wall when I was 9, followed by Liam Gallagher. I mean, I was never going to do well and go for really nice boys. So I think that the whole thing with my dad, and I like a bad boy. There you go. That's just the way it is.
And she talked very frankly about her marriage and divorce from Brian McFadden.
It sounds like you knew that was a mistake before you even married him, did you?
Yeah, and I think if you asked him the same question, I think he'd probably say the same thing. I think that I was certainly very young. My dad had just died. I'd come out of a really long-term relationship, and then I met him and we went to Australia, and I kind of used it as an escape to get away from what I would describe as all the sadness that I was kind of surrounded in after everything that had happened. But you know what? I genuinely don't regret it. I think everything that you do in life, it brings you to where you are. And even with meeting other people, and like even me meeting Spencer, and I think everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
And like I describe stuff pretty much the way they were, and certainly the way that I felt that they were. And I just think it kind of felt like a bit of a disaster from the get-go, really.
And the end of the marriage then, it feels like, from the book, that was a real knockback for you, was it?
I felt like that was my... I felt really, like, I think to fail so publicly as well. And I think a lot of people just assumed it was going to happen anyway. So it was kind of like an I told you moment.
Okay,
and it
yeah.
was there was a lot of interest in it at the time. And I don't think I was equipped to deal with something like that as it was happening. I didn't like have a really solid team around me either that knew what to do. I didn't know what to do. I just felt really embarrassed by the whole thing. I felt like a lot of people kind of had considered that that was the way it was going to end. So that felt really difficult for me. I think I went through a really bad time, like with anxiety and stuff around that time, because I did find it very difficult to deal with all of that.
Yeah. Embarrassed. Yeah. Like, it's an old fashioned word, but like embarrassment yeah. in public like that is kind of hurts, doesn't it?
I know it does. And you can't get away from it. You just have to accept it. Accept it and yeah. just kind of hang your head in shame for a while and then come back out.
These days, though, she's married to Spencer, who loves running marathons. A lot of marathons. She won't join him, but they are well matched.
You and him are quite competitive.
Yeah, yeah, I'd say. Yeah, about most things, to be honest. He is a better runner than me, I can accept that. And I'm gracefully bowing out of that race, but I'm a better tennis player. And I'm more organised, and I can use a washing machine, and he doesn't even know the difference between a washing machine and a dryer. So I'm winning in the
I'd say
the
that's,
home
a, that's a competition he's happy to be losing there. You're there like, I'm winning at doing the laundry. And he's like, you are. You're so great.
Pennies dropping everywhere. Brendan with the very charming Vogue Williams. Now, we are on the Duolingo here on Playback when it comes to speaking football. But Goodison Park, the home of Everton, we know that. But now they've closed their doors. Brian Lally spoke to some True Blues, and it didn't take much prodding to make the grown-ups cry.
It's very emotional today.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. Very emotional. Even coming on the plane, they were starting to cry. First match we went, there was Shamrock Rovers against Everton in a friendly when the Irish teams used to come over that time. Very proud man today to be there in Goodison. I really am.
Quite emotional at the thought of it.
Yeah, it means a lot, you know. And it's just over the years. Good times, yeah.
A lot of people maybe aren't around anymore that you started off
with. My man. Yeah. You know, all she knew was everything. You know, we've known much of the day, we're only kids. Yeah, she's looking down today at me.
What's your greatest memory?
We beat Man United 5-0. That was my first game. Yeah, yeah. It was a long time ago. A long time ago.
5-0?
5-0, yeah. And I thought it was going to be like that every week.
I was going to say that.
We didn't just got married. He taught me the game. And we beat them 5-0.
You'd only just got married. And it was the height of a romantic gesture to take you to a Man
United game. It was, yeah. Of course it was. Yeah, yeah. That's why it lasted so long.
Will you have a little tear in your eye at the end of today?
I bought tissues.
Did you?
Yeah. I'm going to cry. I'm going to cry now.
Oh, such commitment. Meanwhile, with Oliver.
The world's best-selling non-fiction author for children. What an incredible sentence that is.
Indeed it is. And it was Terry Deary of Horrible Histories. A fascinating character and one whose books are responsible for a whole generation of history lovers. This was how it had all begun.
I'd written a Father Christmas joke book, you know, where what was Tarzan's favourite Christmas song? Jungle Bells, Jungle. I didn't say they were great jokes, but it was a huge hit. So the next year they said, will you do a history joke book? And I found some, where did the French buy their guillotines? In the shopping centre. And things like, and they said, these jokes are even worse than the Father Christmas ones. Would you like to put some facts in? And I'm not the historian. But I researched them and found actually the facts were more interesting than the jokes. So I had to make myself become a historian.
Truly terrible jokes, but that humour allows Deary to entice readers in to engage with history.
In a world of wars, poverty and plague, to get somebody coming along and looking at human behaviour and thinking about human behaviour, and in a funny way to engage them and then hit them with the serious bits, the Holocaust, the famine in Ireland and so on. You grab them with the humour.
And let us give you this wee insight into the guillotine.
He wanted it to be painless. That was the problem.
Oh, right,
you know,
okay.
He said, you know, these people have to be executed, but let's not hack about them with an axe. And so he came up with the guillotine. And Benny had to test it because he didn't want to put a live human on and for it to sort of half succeed. So they went to the local mortuary, picked up corpses, put them on the guillotine and chop the heads off. And then I thought, this is actually fascinating.
That is
Could you do that? Could I do it? Pick up a corpse, cut off its head, pick up the bits and carry them back. And this is what history should be. It's measuring yourself against people in the past. Who are you? Who were these people? That's what's fascinating about history.
But not everybody likes his take on history. We give you this headline from the Daily Telegraph.
Horrible Histories author loathes the British Empire with a passion. He says there's nothing brave or courageous. They said this as though it was a bad thing.
How on earth can anybody justify the British Empire? You know, they went out and used the machine gun because they had the Industrial Revolution, the weapons, and wiped out people. There are things which they don't teach you in schools. For example, the Tasmanians. Would you like to ask a native Tasmanian what they think of the British Empire?
Yeah.
No, because 60 years after the British landed, they were all wiped out. That was genocide. Nobody uses that word with regard to the British Empire, but it's true.
And will he be taking an OBE, a knighthood, or indeed any award with Empire in the title, or even striking a pose at number 10? Ah, no, not anytime soon.
You're a cynical soul, really, at the heart of it all.
No, I'm not cynical. I'm realistic. I can see through the way people get into power and stay in power by manipulating other people, and I'm not for manipulating. I don't think that makes me cynical. It makes me a realist.
Terry Deary of Horrible Histories. Now, here in Montrose, gossip, intrigue, ambition, power, hushed whispers and loud petitions.
How are you? Good afternoon to you. Sorry, Ray, I'm suited and built it. I was just around the building.
All right.
In signing the contract, you know what I mean?
No, I don't.
You know what I mean, eh?
No, I don't know what you mean.
You know, good afternoon to you. Good afternoon to you. After the Brits, the man who's tormented and tortured the Irish people most.
Who?
Who do you think?
No, I'm not.
Who do you think, Colton?
Don't mind him. Don't fall.
No, Duffy! I know you said, Ray, I know you said you didn't think Katie Hannon had a chance. I think she's very good. It's down to me, Hoare, now and Bosco. So the three of us are in the running.
It's on. Get in there, Dustin. Go on. Ask the question.
Did you go for it yourself? I thought not.
No.
Why do you think Katie Hannon's not good enough for it, Ray? I think she's great.
I think Katie is great.
Why are you winking at me?
Great. I'm not.
There's cameras in this studio. You're winking at me, Ray Darcy. Why? I thought she was brilliant this afternoon.
Yeah.
I thought she... Look, there's no one like Joe, but I think she's the next best thing.
Yeah.
Besides me.
Well, Katie will be herself and whoever does it will be themselves.
What do you mean by... Why are you winking at me?
I'm not winking at you.
Oh, man. And spare a thought for Alton Conlon in to sing a few songs he had not bargained on this.
It's very simple. Yes. Neil, you ask me a question. Neil's producer outside. Anything at all, Neil? Anything at all? Can he speak to you?
I have a problem, right?
Yeah, okay.
Two magpies are terrorising our golden retriever in the back garden.
Go ahead, sure. Dustin. Sure.
Yeah, and they're actually pecking at him, and the poor golden retriever is driven demented.
Right, that does be terrible. That does be terrible indeed, the tals with the. Actually, Mildred's on the line and she has three magpies terrorising her dog. Mildred, go ahead. You see, that's what you do.
That's what you do, right?
You do. You just go, you think your problem's bad.
Yeah.
And then you get someone else and you go, so it's, Ulton, tell me you went into Supermax in Galway and you got coffee and tell me it was cold, right?
I went into Supermax and I got a terrible cold coffee.
You can't say that about Supermax.
I can.
Okay, you just did.
I've had the coffee.
Funny enough, because Neil's on the line and he said he got a lovely cup of coffee. Right. That's all you have to do. Right. It's spoofing. Absolute spoofers.
You're bringing that. Listen, I'm not in the...
When's your interview?
And that is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week and we'll end with a little bit of reggae in the rain. Embrace it.